The Asian Classics Institute presents What the Buddha Really Meant with Geshe Michael Roach, recorded live in New York City in November of 1998. This is the beginning of Class 1.
Never complains, and she never says anything, never anything, you know, negative. And she said, "I think it's time to go home." So it did feel like that, you know. And it's really, really nice to see everybody again in New York City. And you know, it was a little hard to be in a strange place every week or something. So welcome back to that. And I wanted to thank all the people who worked hard to find this place. I think Michael Wick and, I don't know, Nanette is here, Paul worked on it, and John Stilwell and a bunch of other people. And we looked at some really wild places, but they were too expensive, so we ended up here. I think it'll work out all right. We'll see how it goes. This is the last of the 5-year course classes that became a 7-year course. There's a few people here who actually have been through the whole thing. I think Margie, friend Diane, a few other people have been through the whole 7 years, actually. Then in 99, we'll review the whole 7 years in 1 year. And that'll be like a roller coaster, you know. And then we'll all take a long retreat or something. And the reason I saved this subject for last was, first of all, it's the most difficult. Those of you who were at the logic course may not believe that. But by the way, difficult in the sense of beautiful, it's about emptiness. So, you know, it's not difficult in the sense of logic, okay? It's just in the sense of changing your way of thinking about things. It's difficult, okay? And so it's not That was the first reason. Second reason was when my class got to this subject, and we were about to study it, the abbot came to us and said, "You're all promoted to the next class," which means you skip a whole year. And we said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, you started out with 60 guys and there's only about 5 left. And in the class above you, there's only a few left too." So we decided to, there couldn't be much debating, you know. So this is common after about 10 years in the course, that due to attrition, so we were in what's called the junior class, which loses a whole year of study. And the subject we lost was this subject. So, you know, over the years I've tried to get lamas to teach me it privately. And Rinpoche taught it to us in Sera at our request. There was a group of us when he was abbot. And about halfway through he got ill. And then we were fortunate enough to be at Sera about a month and a half ago. And we studied this subject, which is very difficult, with the, I would say, the greatest scripture teacher in India right now, who's Geshe Thupten Rinchen. And he agreed to give us a few lectures on it, which turned out to be, I think, 25 lectures. It was about 5 hours a day. And it was extraordinary. And I think about 20 people from this group, or that we picked up on the way to India, ended up studying it. So much of what you hear is going to be, I don't think anyone could give an explanation like that. I don't believe there's another person around who's teaching who could give an explanation like that. And so you're going to get pretty much fed directly from what he taught us, which was extraordinary. People spend their lives trying to figure out this particular subject. Professor Thurman spent about 10 years on it as his doctoral work, and Jeffrey Hopkins has spent the last 8 years on it trying to figure out what it's about. And so you're going to get it served up from Geshe Thupten Rinchen, actually, and in a very easy way, in a beautiful way, and a correct way. And that's just beautiful. That's very wonderful. So we'll start. When you're in the monastery, you spend, the first course is 12 years long on the perfection of wisdom. And about 10 years into the course, then they start the sukho. Sukho means supplementary subjects. For example, they will cover dependent origination, which means the study of the wheel of life. And if you're interested, we'll be doing that on Friday nights. We'll be going through the whole painting of the Wheel of Life starting tomorrow night, I think. And that takes maybe 4 months in a monastic schedule. Then you hit a thing called Chang'e, okay? So you gotta realize you've been memorizing since you were 7. At the age of 13 or 14, you were allowed to go to your first debates. And now you're something like 25. And you've been studying the same school, which is Madhyamika, for your whole life. And then they hit you with Chang'e. So if you want to impress people who know what monks study, and they say, "What are you studying nowadays?" You say, "Oh, not much, just Chang'e." You know, in Chang'e, they take everything you know about emptiness, everything you studied for 10 years, 15 years, and they tell you to throw it out. And they say, "Now forget all that. Now you're in a different school." Okay? And it's basically the study of the mind-only school. Okay? And for the next year or 2 years, we say you put on a mind-only hat, meaning you forget your former identity. It's like they give you a new gang name or something, and they say, "Okay, you're not Madhyamika anymore, you're mind only." And you can tell the guys who are studying Chang'e, because they wander around the debate ground making crazy statements. And, you know, like they're lost in another school for 2 years. You know, and it's a beautiful thing because they have very special ideas about emptiness. And they help you clarify your understanding of emptiness. So You're going to enter the world of mind-only school. You will forget all the Madhyamika you ever had here, okay? And it's like you're starting to study emptiness over again. And that's how it was. Yeah. John asked if this is a better or more correct description of emptiness than the middle way. They never tell you that kind of stuff. Okay. We'll get there. Tongue, the word tongue is made of two parts. Say tongden. Ngeden. Tongden. Ngeden. Tongden. Right, this is the first part of tongue, tongden, right? And then ngeden is the second part of tongue. So tongue, the word tongue is made from tongue and nge. Say tongden, ngeden, tongden, ngeden. Okay, tongue means something you have to interpret. Something you have to, for example, if someone is speaking literally or figuratively, okay? Tongden means figurative. For example, the Buddha once said that you should kill your father and kill your mother, okay? Was he speaking literally or figuratively? Okay, depends on who your father and mother are, I guess, but no, not really. He was speaking figuratively, right? And tongden means that. The basic meaning of tongden means figurative, okay? And what he meant when he said kill your father and kill your mother was when the time comes, if it's necessary, if the home life becomes a distraction and you can't practice properly, then leave, you know, leave it. And leave it until you're settled spiritually and then you can go back. Huh?
Why did he say kill? Why did he say
kill? Why did he say kill? He's exaggerating for effect. The most famous situation he did that was the Heart Sutra. There's no eye, there's no ear, there's no nose. He's pointing to his nose, right? No nose, no tongue, okay? Why do people ever exaggerate? The Lama who taught us this course in Saramay gave the example of if you have a student who is constantly dropping things and breaking things, and you give them a cup to go wash it for you, and then he said, "Kayadi joda," which means, "And don't forget, could you please smash that cup in the sink for me?" You know, you know. And it's just a way of saying, without being boring, you know, you broke like five before, and please be a little more careful this one, okay? Like that. There's a reason behind it. We call it gongxi. Say gongxi.
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 Gongxi means what the person has in mind. You know, gongxi means, why did that person say that? You know, what is it they really want from you when they say, oh, could you please break my most precious cup, please? You know, what do they want out of you? What do they want you to think of? And that's called gongxi. So in the study of tongue, the gongxi is essential. Gongxi means, what did they really have in mind when they said something that wasn't true or that was exaggerated? Okay, so that's the basic meaning of tongden, which is figurative. Then ngeden means literal. Okay. And you can describe even tongue in three different ways, okay? And I'll tell you the three. The first is in words, okay? Like my words can be literal or figurative. You know, when I'm speaking, I can either mean what I say or I can mean something else, okay? And oftentimes parents will do this to help the children, right? There's a story in Buddhism about the Buddha says there's some children playing a game and the house catches on fire, and the father runs in and says, "You have to run out." And they say, "No, we don't want to," you know. And then he says, "I got a better game outside," you know. And then they run out, you know what I mean? So this is where the Buddha, there's no match between what the person said and what reality is. Okay, that's the first test. So on the level of expression, You can have figurative or literal. Which means, is there a match between two things? What two things? Yeah, what they say and what they mean. Okay? Is there a match? Between what they say and what they mean. In the Buddha, you know, taught the, there were three great periods in the Buddha's mission on this planet. He went through three great phases in his teaching career. He seemed to be almost different people during each of those three great phases. Those are known as the three turnings of the wheel of the Dharma. Okay, and in the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, for example, Lord Buddha said, all the things around you that you see exist from their own side. They exist by their own right. They have their own nature. Okay. Then a few years later, he got up on Vulture's Peak and said, that's not really the case. Nothing has its own nature, okay? Nothing exists from its own side. Nothing exists with any quality of its own. Nothing at all, okay? And then in the third turning of the wheel, he said something else, okay? So this is an example of one of those or two of those has to be figurative. Actually, two of them, right? Two of them have to be what he didn't mean what he said, okay? And now it's up to us to figure it out, all right? That's an example of expression. How about on the level of reality, meaning does the way an object appears to be and does the way the object really is, do they match or not? Okay? This appears to be, does the way this thing appears to you match what it really is? If it doesn't, we call it figurative. Okay? Tang dun. If it does, we call it nghe, literal, nghe dun. Okay? And that's a test of figurative or literal in reality, you see? Not by expressions. We're not talking something that somebody said, you know, please break this cup. Does he really want me to break the cup? You know, no, he wants you to be careful with the cup, okay? But the same is true of objects, okay? Is this object lying to you or not? Okay? Does the reality of this pen match what it seems to you to be or not? And if it did match, we would call it literal. And if it didn't match, we would call it figurative. Okay? So, tang dun and nghe dun can extend to reality itself. In the first case, we're talking about whether what you say is what you mean. Whether what you say matches what you mean. Here we're saying, does the way a thing appears to you, does the way it appears to you match the way it really is or not? Or is something going on to deceive you? Is there an illusion here? Okay? Is there a correspondence between the way it looks to you and the way it really is, or are they completely different? Okay, and that's figurative and literal on the, in the sense of reality itself. Got it? Okay. Third level of tange. On the level of understanding, this refers to two states of mind. Okay, some of the older students have had them. We'll go very briefly. One is called sema. Say sema. Sema. Sema means, in Sanskrit, it's pramana. Most of you know it. And it means a correct or accurate perception. Technically, it means a valid perception, but we won't get into that. Okay? An accurate perception is called a pramana or a sema. Okay? So, for example, if you are looking at this cylinder and you happen to see it as white and black, you're having a tema. You're having a pramana, okay? If you have a normal set of fingers and you look at your hand and count five, you're having a pramana, okay? How many pramanas do you have during the day? We say 65. When was it? 64 or 65? I don't remember. Anyway, 60-something per millisecond, okay? You're having prominence, okay? Non-prominence or non-semis are very rare, okay? Meaning, people call it cognitive dissonance thing. It just means, is it accurate or not, you know? Are you seeing a pen or not? Yeah, you're seeing a pen. Now, if you were really drunk or on a drug, or if you were very angry or very jealous or something like that, it might actually make you see something that's not there. That's the opposite of a tsema, okay? Sometimes motion can do that. Motion can play tricks where you think you see something moving. You think the shore is moving when you're moving or something like that, okay? Those are non-tsemas. If you're having a tsema about something, we call it literal. On the level of perception or understanding. This is the third level of figurative or literal, right? What was the first level? Does what the guy says match what the guy means? And if it does, we call it literal. Okay? What's the second level of literal is, does the reality of that thing match the way it appears to you? Which is on the level of reality, right? And then the third one is on the level of perception, you know. Does the way I think it is match what it is? Is it really a white and black cylinder, or am I on an acid trip or something? Okay? Okay? Those are the three levels of literal and figurative. Yeah?
Can you just remind me what the opposite of tsema was?
It's called tsemin, but in the study of Chang'e, we use another word. Say yichi. Yichi. Yichi means approximation. It's a state of mind where you are sort of understanding something. Okay? Like if I say, have you seen emptiness directly? You can say, no, I didn't have a direct tsema. I didn't have a direct accurate perception about it. Well, do you have a yichi about it? Can you sort of, in a fuzzy way, approximate it in your mind and say, yeah, you taught that pen thing so many days, you know. I have some kind of a fuzzy picture in my mind. That's called a yichi, okay? So the first is literal and the second one is figurative, all right? In the sense of perception. Okay, the first one, what it sees and what the thing is match perfectly, okay? The way it sees and the way the thing is match perfectly. In the second one, the way it sees and the way the thing is are just kind of fuzzy, okay, fuzzily related, all right? Three different kinds of tenge. We're going to start, the most of the course will be about tenge in the sense of verbs, words, okay, verbalizations. Did the guy mean it when he said it, okay? When did the guy mean it, what he said, and when did he didn't mean it? Who's the guy? Lord Buddha, okay? What's the thing he said that bothers people? No, first he said, besides killing your parents, first he said, everything exists really, truly, the way you see it, from its own side, by nature, by definition. Then later on in his life, he changes his mind. He says, nothing. Sukmed, Tsoamed, Dhammed, Chimed, Romed, Rechamed, Chimedo, nothing. Nothing exists by definition, you know. And he gets more radical. So what's going to happen in the end of his life? He's going to meet certain people like, say, Dundam, Yanda, Pot, Dundam, Yanda, Pot. We're going to call him the Bodhisattva, okay? His whole name is Dindayanda Pat. I had to get Art to help me with the Sanskrit. It's like Paramartha Sadgutta or something. Samudgata, okay? Paramartha. Do you want me to call him Paramartha Samudgata, or should we call him the Bodhisattva? Let's call him the Bodhisattva, okay? This is a bodhisattva who meets the Buddha later on in his life. The Buddha has spent years teaching that all sorts of things, especially you and everything about you, the parts of you, exist from their own side. They have their own reality. They do have some kind of nature. And then later on, Lord Buddha, you know, gets up on this big mountain called Rajgir Peak, Vulture's Peak, and suddenly he changes his tune and he says, nothing has any nature. Nothing exists by definition. Nothing has any reality from its own side, right? So what happens in the third period of his life? He's like getting old. He's relaxing up in a place called Shravasti, and people start to approach him. And this is one of them. This is the bodhisattva called Dindamyandapat. And he says, you know, we really appreciated it when you gave your first round of teachings, you know, your first wheel of the Dharma. Meaning he taught for a whole period of years certain subjects. He taught like seven great subjects. And he says, we appreciate all the subjects you taught. We were very interested. You taught about the five heaps. You taught about the four Arya truths. You taught about the eightfold Arya path. You know, you taught all these, the 18 parts of the human being, you know. You talked about the 12 doors of sense. You taught us all these beautiful ways of looking at the world. You know, and then as you were finishing, you always told us that they existed from their own side, that they had some nature of their own, or they had some reality of their own. Okay? Then you got up on Vulture's Peak. You know, we don't know what happened, but then you started telling us nothing exists by its own sign. Nothing exists by nature. Nothing has any definition of its own. All the things around you don't exist the way you think they do. Period. Nothing. You know, so what does this bodhisattva ask the Buddha? what were you thinking of? You know, okay, that is, by the way, called the bodhisattva's question in this study of Chang'e. This is the whole start of the fight. Okay, the whole start of this. You know, people memorize this book. You know, you get a special award in the monastery if you memorize this. It's 230 pages long. And many people memorize it, and because it's so important. And here's the first opening salvos, you know. This poor bodhisattva is getting, he's confused, you know. And he comes up to Buddha and says, first you say one thing, and then you say the exact opposite. Now could you tell us what you mean, you know? Could you tell us what's going on? And why did you do that? And which one is true, if any, or is it something else? Okay? Which, by the way, is possible, right? Like, it could be a mix, right? Maybe some things do exist by nature and some don't. You know, we don't know what the Buddha's going to say, right? But this is later on in his career. This is like wrapping up his career, and this bodhisattva is encountering the Buddha and saying, hey, you know, we know you're infallible and everything, and you never contradict it. You cannot contradict yourself, but it really seems like you did. You know, and those are the actual thinking, you know, the text goes like that, you know you're infallible. So it can't be that you say on Monday that everything is A, and then on Tuesday you say everything is B. What were you trying to do, you know? Why did you say that? What was the point? Okay, and that's called the bodhisattva's question. Okay, the question is so famous that the chapter got named the chapter of the bodhisattva's question. So, Dindamyandapat. And then you can take this out, and you can call it Shube. Liu. Shube means, Shuba is honorific for to ask a question. It's like to proffer a question. It's very high language, you know. The bodhisattva proffers a question to Lord Buddha. Okay. Shube Liu. Liu means this is just one chapter out of a bunch of chapters in an important book. Okay. So Liu means chapter. So if people say, what's the root text for what you're studying, you know, the ultimate source for what you're studying, you're going to say, oh, it's the chapter that was requested by the Bodhisattva Dundam Yandap Park, okay? Paramartha Samudgata, okay? We'll call him the Bodhisattva, okay? Make it easy. Okay, this is the chapter requested by the Bodhisattva. Why is it called the chapter requested by the Bodhisattva? Because that's how it starts out. He says, hey, first you taught that, then you taught that. We know you can't contradict yourself. You're a smart guy. What did you mean? You know, what point were you getting at? Why did you do that? Which one is true? Or are neither of them true? Okay, and that's how the whole point starts. Now, if you're a mind-only school person, you like this book a lot, because this is the source for the mind-only school. Okay? So, you know, it's an excuse to go off and explain the mind-only system. All right? There are two great sources for explaining what the Buddha really meant. Okay? And this is one of them. If you belong to the mind-only school, you like this one. Okay? Who wrote this book? Who wrote the chapter requested by Dundam Yandap Park? I'll give you a clue, it's in the Kangyur. Lord Buddha, okay? Lord Buddha, all right? It's like the Heart Sutra or something like that, okay? This is by Lord Buddha. And if you're in the mind-only school, this is the one. If somebody says, what did the Buddha really mean? You know, how are we supposed to interpret his seemingly contradictory statements? First he says, everything isn't empty. And then he says, everything is empty. Well, how are we supposed to take that? If you're a mind-only school person, you say, oh, we got to go to this sutra, this piece of this sutra called Dundam Yandap Shubhubhu. And in fact, they build their whole system from the answer that the Buddha is about to give. The whole mind-only school system is based on this answer. Okay? I'll talk a little bit about what mind-only means. There are four great schools of ancient India, and don't confuse them with the four Tibetan traditions. Okay, sometimes people do that. They go out and they say, Michael Roach was criticizing the poor mind-only school, you know, and hope there's none of those lamas in New York tonight. You know, these people died centuries ago, okay? These are four great schools of ancient India. Okay, don't confuse them with Sakya, Gelug, Nyingma, Kagyu, okay, of Tibet. First one is highest, is middle way. Second is mind only. Third is called sutrist. But these are mainly the logic and perceptual theory schools. And then you have the Abhidharma schools, or higher knowledge. Traditionally, we would divide it like this. Everybody above the squiggly line is higher way, Mahayana, and everybody below the squiggly line is Hinayana, traditionally, okay? People say, what's your opinion of Hinayana or Theravada? And, you know, do Tibetans respect Theravada? We spent 10 years on Abhidharma. We spent the first 10 years on Abhidharma. You know what I mean? So, yeah, they take it very seriously and they study it very well. And they don't disparage it at all. Okay? Sutra schools, mind-only school, and then middle-way school. And what differentiates them the most is how they explain emptiness. Okay? The way in which they explain emptiness. The big difference between all four schools is how they explain emptiness. Lord Buddha taught how many of these schools? Huh?
All four.
All right. He taught four different schools. Three and a half of them are wrong about emptiness. Okay? Three and a half of them are wrong about emptiness. So, what's wrong with this Buddha, you know? So, why is he doing that? You see? And that becomes another question. All right? What's the use of teaching it those other three and a half ways? And it's to sharpen your thinking about emptiness, okay? And in the monastery, if you cannot explain the way that these four schools explain emptiness, they know you don't understand emptiness. They'll say, give me the second school's idea of emptiness. And people say, I don't know. And they say, well then do you think you understand emptiness? And they say, well, that was 2,000 years ago, you know, I'm living in 1998. I don't need to know what people who have been dead for 2,000 years thought about emptiness and when it was wrong, you know. But that's not why the Buddha taught it. The Buddha taught each of these schools because in any human audience, 25% of the people will think about emptiness the way the Abhidhamma people do. 25% of the people will think about it the way the Sutra people do. 25% of the people will automatically start to come up with mind-only ideas, and 25% of the people, or less, will start thinking of it the middle way school. So it's very interesting. The Buddha taught four schools because there are four personality types. There are four ways of thinking. And you are in one of those four. Okay? You're already in one of those four. You are already naturally thinking about about emptiness in a certain way. But just before you walked in here, before you learned Buddhism at all, you were already thinking about emptiness a certain way. And it'd be easy to categorize you into one of the four if you knew emptiness properly, if you knew about emptiness well. So it's very cool that you can actually help any kind of person if you know the four schools. You see what I mean? You can find in any human mind, and also in any one human mind, four different ways of thinking about emptiness, and 3.5 of them are wrong. Okay. What's the big deal about knowing emptiness? We're going to go to a quotation from Lord Buddha, which Jetsun Kapa answers the same question. We're going to study a book by Jetsun Kapa. And somebody says, okay, so there's four ways of understanding emptiness. Big deal, I mean, one is okay for me. You know, I don't really care which one, just to give me one of them. And maybe the easier one would be better for me. You know, okay? And then Jetsun Kapa pulls out a quotation. Say Mishepe, Droa, Kyam. Mishepe, Droa, Kyam. There's a word that comes before that I didn't write here, which is Tongba, okay? Tongba means emptiness. Right? So the real quotation, it's a whole line, it's a whole big verse. I didn't want to give you the whole verse, but Tongba means emptiness. Mishepe means because you don't understand it, or because they don't understand it. Droa means Droa means people, living beings. Kyam means they wander around hopelessly in suffering. Okay, Kyam means to wander around like dazed, like in a bunch of razor blades or something. You know, it's a very horrible word actually. Okay, but because they don't understand emptiness, people just wander around in life hurting themselves every day, every hour, okay? And this is like, I was just sick for 4 days in bed. It was really cool. Didn't have to wash any dishes. And and it was very, very, very painful. And the idea of Buddhism, the whole point of Buddhism is that there's a way to stop it. If you understand how to stop it, you can stop it. You know, you don't have to go through that. Sooner or later, everybody in this room will end up horizontal in some bed somewhere with children who don't really want to take care of you, or some attendant in a nursing home who would rather that you didn't yell, and will probably let you know that. And that's what you have to look forward to. I mean, every person sitting here will be in a bed, no matter how strong you are, or how smart you are, how much money you have, or what kind of friends you have, or how beautiful your life has been to now, you will end up there. And the question is, do you have to or not? This text, this quotation is saying, the reason you do that is because you don't understand emptiness. So, you know, at the very beginning of his book, which you are about to study, Jetsun Kapa says, look, this is why you get old. This is why you get sick. This is why your body starts to lose its energy, and your eyes and your mind and everything else. There's a reason for that, and it's that you don't understand emptiness. See, people were accusing him, saying, you know, you're just a nitpicker, philosophical nitpicker, you know. Why are you going to write this huge book about what five different people think about emptiness? You know, who cares? Let's go meditate or something, you know what I mean? And he quotes, this is a quotation by Lord Buddha, okay? It's from a sutra requested by Rashtrapala, okay? And it's in your reading. And Jetsun Kapa says, you don't get it, you know. Lord Buddha himself said, it's because people don't understand emptiness that they have to suffer, okay? So what we're going to do, you know, I've been in classes where they explain the mind-only school system. I remember being in India, being bored to death. I was only like a week old Buddhist, and this great Western scholar came and covered the board with this weird stuff, and I was bored to death. And I said, what's going on, you know, and what's this guy doing this for, you know, and what's the point, you know? And it just seemed like a waste of time, or he was just trying to show that he knew 44 Sanskrit verbs or something, and it strikes you like that, okay? But Jetsun Kapa is saying, you have to know emptiness. And it's not I'm not saying that. Buddha is saying that. You have to know emptiness well. If you get to understand the mind-only schools about emptiness, idea about emptiness, then your understanding of emptiness will be really, really sweet, okay? Your understanding it the middle way school way, Majjhimika, will be 10 times clearer. It's a trick. Okay, the whole mind-only school system, which is not true, okay, or is it, was spoken by Lord Buddha to trick you into thinking more about emptiness. Okay, I mean, he spent years, decades of his life talking about something which is false, or is it, okay, and he's trying to get you to think about emptiness more, okay. Like, mind-only is a very nice step between where you are now and where you want to be. You know? It's a very, very interesting hybrid of what you think now and what you should be thinking later. You know? It's like going across a bridge. And it's very, very beautiful for that reason. So you have to study, we're going to study emptiness according to mind-only school. And Sal's going to be raising his arm and saying, that's not what you said in the emptiness classes before, and I'm going to say, what hat do you have on? In the monastery they say, don't forget to keep your mind-only hat on. That, you know, hey, this is like a pandit's hat, okay, not a dunce hat. And they say, don't forget what hat you have on, you know. And when you're in mind-only school class in the monastery, you can't talk about other schools. Our teacher in the monastery, Geshe Tutarinchen, kept saying what? He said, close that Majjhimika door. Close that middle way door. I don't want to hear. Sometimes one student would pipe up and he'd say, no, we closed that door. Okay, you're in the mind-only school. Very beautiful school. Very exquisite school. Okay. All right. So, because they don't understand, it's not true that you can just reach happiness or something like that by meditating all the time. Or it's important. You have to. You can't perceive emptiness directly without meditating. And it's not true that you can perceive it just doing prayers all the time or you know, sitting and watching your breath or something like that. It's not true. And it's not a Gelugpa idea and it's not a Tibetan idea. This is a quotation. The full quotation is in your reading. And it's by Lord Buddha himself. And it says, you have to understand emptiness. You have to come to understand it. Compassion is good, and you're going to need compassion. But if you don't understand emptiness, you will never stop suffering. You must understand emptiness to stop your death and your aging. And you can. You know, you can stop those processes, but you have to understand emptiness. Okay? Yeah.
So if I'm understanding it, then if you don't understand any of the school's teachings on emptiness, then you don't have a complete understanding of emptiness.
Yeah, he said that if you don't understand any of the school's teachings on emptiness, then you don't understand emptiness thoroughly. That's of course. Yeah, that's the idea. Yeah, I mean, if when you get really good, you should be able to say, this is how the first school thinks emptiness is, and this is what the second school thinks, and this is what the third school thinks, and this is what the lower Madhyamika thinks, and this is what the higher Madhyamika thinks. And it's not just for showing off what you know. Because each of those lower 3.5 are ideas that any normal person will have during their career of trying to understand emptiness. It's very interesting. After you get good at it, you can listen to some guy describe emptiness in a lecture hall and say, oh yeah, he got to number 2, that's not bad. You know, or oh, he's up to 3, that's really good, you know, mind only, you know. And also when you hear a bad explanation of emptiness, you'll be able to pinpoint it. You'll be able to say, yeah, in the development of a normal person's thought, this guy is exactly halfway to what emptiness really is. And you can just say, yeah, you've got to go 2 more stages and then you've got to meditate a lot and then you'll see emptiness directly. You know what I mean? So it's important to know the 4 schools. It's not just a philosophical game. The point is to get your own mind up to those 4 schools so that you reach the last one. Okay? And then if you don't want to die in this life, you use the last one to practice tantra. That's the whole point. Okay? That's the whole point of it. Okay? All right. Last thing, right? Before the break. Mm-hmm. The people who went with me to Sarah found out where the last thing came from. The Lama there, 2 hours before finishing, would say, last point. Say Taptul.
Taptul.
The whole verse says, by the way, I'll read it for good luck. Tomba shiwa kewa mebe tsu, mi shepe ni joa kyam girpa, dedak tu che ngawe taptul dang, riba gyada kini zubarze, means the Buddhas know that people have to see emptiness or else they will continue to suffer. You know, the Buddhas know that if you could see emptiness directly in this life, you could stop your suffering. And I'm not talking unhappiness. I'm talking actual physical aging and death and things like that. They know that if you saw those things, you could begin the process of stopping even your aging and even your death. And definitely all the screwy things in your life. Okay, all the things that are going wrong. You could stop them. They know that. So how do they get people to study emptiness? You know, how do they... Do they drag them into a public school X-55, you know, and with a lasso and say, okay, we're going to study Prasangika. You know, you sit down. You're going to get Nagarjuna's, you know, top theory, 500 pages. It takes 7 years, okay? And they said, no, I don't want to, you know, I got a date tonight. Okay. You know what I mean? Nobody put up with that. So they use taptul. Say taptul.
Taptul.
Taptul in here means, tapke means skillful means. They trick you into studying emptiness. Okay? They trick you into studying. Taptul means, tapke, skillful means doing something highly unusual to get a student to think. Okay? Like teach them lower Madhyamika for 10 years. Until they get very comfortable with it. And then call them into the debate ground one day and say, forget everything you learned. It's all wrong. Here's the new one. You know, like wait till, this is very common with you know, really good lamas. They'll teach you something, make sure you're comfortable with it, and then suddenly they'll just freak you out with something else. You know what I mean? The minute you're comfortable, finally, with something, then they'll say, no, forget all that. Now we're going to do something else, you know. We're going to do something totally different. You know, and then suddenly you're dragged on to another thing. It's to make you think, you know. And tabtsul means out of compassion. The verse says, out of compassion, the Buddha's try to trick people into coming to the correct idea of emptiness. Okay? They can't handle 100% emptiness. So what do? Oh, teach them some other system that's close to emptiness. And then teach them another system that's closer to emptiness when they get more ready. And then when they're really ready, hit them on the top with 100% emptiness. And then after that, teach them Tantra. You see what I mean? And keep moving them up through the levels. You know what I mean? And that's the idea. So Tabtsul means the Buddha himself said, this is the method I use. Okay? You know, first I teach you something that you can relate to. When you get comfortable with it, then I kick out the chair again. I say, no, what's real is up here. You know, and then when you get comfortable with that, I rip that down and start again. And then when you get comfortable with that, we move on. And you force them up the ladder like that. That's the idea of Tabtsul. Okay? Tabtsul means that. The second part here is Rigpa Gya. Say Rigpa. Gya. Rigpa Gya. Rigpa means good. What did you say? Good reasons. Good reasons. Gya here means 100, but it's standing for Tayepa. Say Tayepa. Tayepa means countless. Okay, some, like we say zillion sometimes, or jillion. In Tibetan they say 100, okay, or 9, or, you know. I don't know why. No, there's just these words in different languages, you know. When they say Semtiengu or something, it means 9 people means all humanity in Tibetan. Or sometimes they'll say Ganden Hagyama. You know, 100 deities in Tushita. There's billions there, but they're just, it's a number for a lot. Okay, a zillion, call it a zillion, okay? But anyway, it's stated in this quotation by Lord Buddha himself that he will use 2 methods to induce people to understand emptiness. One, he will trick you with all different kinds of school systems. Okay? He'll go through 10 years of explaining something a certain way, and then in year number 11 say, by the way, none of that's true, but now you're ready to hear the better one. Okay? And that's very typical for Buddhists. That's called Tabtsul, right? But the second one, Rigpa Gya, means he will present you with hundreds and hundreds of different logical ways of understanding emptiness. Okay? And here Jetsun Kapa is referring to the idea that, you know, you could go home and eat a special kind of Twinkie and hope to see something about emptiness or something. You know, he says, no, you have to think. You know, someone has to explain it to you over and over and over again in hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of different ways, different angles, different reasons, different proofs, different descriptions, you know, different ways of getting at the same goal, getting you to see emptiness directly. How long does it take to see emptiness directly? It's like 20 minutes, okay? 20 minutes. How long does it take to get to that 20 minutes? Something like 76 million eons, okay, or something, seriously. I mean, it's a long time. And during that time, you have to think. And someone has to give you different explanations of emptiness, and you have to understand them. And then they have to say, junk that now, go to the next one. And you keep building up your understanding of emptiness, okay? And that's the Jetsun Kapa is going to say, look, Lord Buddha did that. He predicted he would do that. He told us he would do that. He said he would fake us out with different systems. And then he said, by the way, I'm going to show you 1,000 different ways to think about emptiness. And only then can you stop your own suffering. Okay, only then can you see emptiness by yourself. So the idea here is to learn some new ideas of how to think about emptiness. You haven't heard these ideas much yet, okay? There are going to be some fresh ideas of how to think about emptiness. The syllabus goes like this, okay? We go through the mind-only schools system for about 7 or 8 classes. In the 9th class, we'll tell you to junk it, and we'll go up to lower Madhyamika, okay? And then in the 10th class, we'll say jump that one, and we'll go up to upper Madhyamika. We'll see if there's any other classes after that, okay? All right? But that's the general structure of the syllabus. We'll go through. Tonight is what's called the Bodhisattva's question. So now you know roughly the contents of his question. You know, first you taught that, then you taught that. What are you? We know you're not crazy because you're Lord Buddha. You know, what did you have in mind? What were you trying to do? Okay? And that's his initial question. And then Jetsun Kapa in his text ends up teaching you mind-only and middle way at the same time. He uses mind-only as a trick to get you to study middle way. Okay? I'd like to take a break there, and we'll start again in about 5 or 10 minutes. Oh, just so you know, this is Geshe Thupten Rinchen teaching Chang'e, okay? He's a real slave master, and no, he's really tough, and he would sometimes, the last class he stretched on to 4 hours of extremely difficult material, and I forgot to mention, we made a video of the whole thing. It's about, I don't know, 60, 70 hours with translation, with simultaneous translation. And we'll never reach the detail that he reached. If you really want to know it well, on your syllabus, there's the numbers of the classes that he gave that relate to each lecture I'm giving. So if you're a fanatic and you're not confused enough, you can get either the audio or the video. I don't think the video is available yet because we had to change some of it from Indian system, you know. But the audio is generally pretty clean, and I guess we'll try to keep a copy in the store maybe. But I think Aura will be in charge of that. It's a very, very beautiful class. Every 5 minutes or so he would stop, we would translate, and then it's extremely detailed and extremely extraordinary presentation. I don't think anyone has ever been, you know, in English, I don't think those things have ever been said in public. So it'd be really nice if you're really fanatic, one of these courses would be about 12 or 13 hours of his lectures. So you're welcome to try that too. Okay. We also have notes of those hundreds of pages of notes taken by students. I think Winston has finished a very fine set of notes, and Robert Chilton did a fine set of notes but hasn't typed them yet because I have them. Okay, and you can talk to Winston maybe if you'd like to see those notes. They're pretty extraordinary too. Okay. Somebody then comes up to Jetsun Kapa and says, well, how do you know when the Buddha was saying what he meant, and how do you know when he wasn't saying what he meant? You know, what do you use to judge? And Jetsun Kapa says, well, let me ask you a question. Do you think we judge it from what he said? Like, when the Buddha finally sat down and said, here's what I really meant, do we use that to figure out what he really meant or not? What do you guess?
No.
No, okay. Why? Because he might be doing it again. All right? You got to get used to that. You know, you don't use the Buddha's speech to figure out if the Buddha was being literal or not. Even when the Buddha says, this time I promise I'm giving you the whole thing. Okay? All right? You can't do that. Because each time he taught emptiness to each group of students, he said, now here's the way, this is really how it is, you know. And then he taught emptiness to them. Because if he said, okay, I'm going to teach you emptiness for like 3 weeks, and it's all wrong, okay? I mean, you can't do that, right? So you can't use, the first thing Jetsun Kapa establishes is, you can't use the Buddha saying, okay, this time I'm being literal, to decide whether or not he's being literal. Okay? Can't do that. That's the first rule of Trange. Okay? Even when he says he's being literal, you can't be sure. So what do you use? Okay? What do you use to decide if he's being tapsu, which means what? If the Buddha is being skillful means, which means, you know, maybe half of what he's telling you about emptiness is not true at all, but he's just trying to move you up one more step in your understanding, right? If he's doing that, how do you know? How can you catch him doing it? Okay, how do you know when the teacher is doing that or not? You know, how can you figure out that he doesn't mean what he said on that particular day about emptiness? He was just trying to simplify it for us, or something like that. How do you know? What do you use to judge? And this becomes a big fight throughout Buddhism, all right? Even on the question, obviously the mind-only school and the middle-way school, right? They're not going to agree on what emptiness means, right? But they can't even agree, and they will not agree, and you'll see that they don't agree on when did the Buddha mean what he said, and how do you know when he meant what he said, you see? So in Trange, you're not only going to study what two different people think Lord Buddha meant when he taught different kinds of emptiness, you're also going to get two different stories on how to tell when the Buddha's telling it literally. Okay? Each school is going to have their own idea of what literal means. And each school is going to have their own idea of what figurative means. Okay? And very important. Very important. So they're not even going to agree on what it means when the Buddha was being figurative or literal. Okay? Much less agreeing on what he said. Okay, so then we're going to learn two different things there. Okay, is this a valid exercise? You know, isn't it sort of insulting to Lord Buddha to say we don't trust anything you say? You know, we have to develop methods of figuring out what you really mean because you just seem to wander all over the place. You know, we've developed a method called Trange, the art of interpretation, to figure out what you really mean. You know, is this some kind of insult to Lord Buddha? I mean, let's say His Holiness gave some lectures in New York, you know, and at the end, you know, Professor Thurman or someone got up and said, we appreciate your lecture, you know, but in the first two lectures you said one thing, and in the second two lectures you said something else, and, you know, could you enlighten us? You know, what do you mean? What do you really mean? We know you're not going to contradict yourself, but would you mind explaining what you really mean? I mean, could you just tell us which one is right, you know, if any, okay? And then wouldn't that seem like some kind of, you know, people are saying to Jetsun Kapa, it's a little impertinent, you know, to say you're going to figure out why the Buddha seemed to contradict himself all the time, okay? And then Jetsun Kapa gives his answer, and it's in your reading. It's one of the most beautiful quotations of all Buddhism. And I think for Westerners, it's maybe one of the most important quotations. I think you should know it. Okay, I'm not going to write the whole thing because it would take too long. But you have the whole thing in your reading. It's on page 9. Okay, say Ngayika.
Ngayika.
This is Lord Buddha himself talking in a sutra, a very famous sutra. And the first thing he says is, the first piece here is Ngayika. Nga means me. Ngayi means my. Ka means what I teach you. The things I teach you. Okay? The words that I speak. Ngayika. I'm going to skip to the third line, okay? Say Sershin.
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 Ser means gold. Gold. Shin means treat it like gold. You have to appreciate ancient India, you know. You have to appreciate India in 1998, okay? Hasn't changed. People wear gold all over their faces, their arms, their ankles, their bracelets, everywhere. It's beautiful. It's not just for beauty. Women in the fields are working in the rice paddies with their gold on. Why? You can't trust the banks. They might collapse any day. No, like Russia, you know. I have all these friends in Russia now with credit cards, and they throw them around like frisbees because they don't work anymore because the bank is gone. And stuff like that, you know. And you can't trust the bank in India. So you don't put your money in the bank. So where do you put it? In your house? You live in a mud shack. You can't lock the door, you know. So you wear it all the time. And you attach it to yourself, you know. And gold is important. Gold is very important in India. It's your life. You know, if you need to eat or something happens, you take it off and you sell it, okay? And if you're a buyer, you don't just take it, you know. You don't just take it. Somebody says, this is gold, you know. We're talking India, right? I mean, there's 50,000 ways in India to cheat somebody on gold, okay? And what you do, first thing you do is you burn it, you know. You melt some and you see if it's really acting like gold. Okay, that's called sick, okay? Sick means that. It was the same in the Buddha's time, okay? 2,500 years ago. Things haven't changed there. Okay. Sek means to burn. To melt it, actually. Che, you know from the Dorje Chupa, same verb, which means to cut. Okay, take some, you know, what do you call those? Snips and cut it. Cut it in a few places and see if there's anything inside. You know, see if it's hollow, see if there's other metals inside, like that. Okay, dar means touchstone or litmus test or something like that. Take a special stone, rub the gold on it, and see if it acts right. Okay, that's called dar. Dar means put it on a touchstone. Literally, dar means to file something. Okay. So Buddha, in this very famous quotation, is saying, "Don't believe what I say." Okay, anything I ever say, don't believe me. Okay. This is one of the things that attracted me to Buddhism. I don't know about you, but that the Buddha himself, the leader of the religion, is telling you, look, just because I said it, okay, say Guchir Min. Guchir Min. Guchir means out of respect for me, Lord Buddha, the omniscient one. Okay? Guchir means out of respect for me, the highest being in the universe, the omniscient one. Min means what? Don't. Okay? Don't believe what I say. Okay? So don't just say, oh, Lord Buddha said it, we have to follow it. He says, that's the last kind of Buddhist I want. I don't want Buddhists like that. You know? Guchir Min means, I don't want people who say, oh, you know, so-and-so said so, Lord Buddha said so, Dalai Lama said so, it must be okay, it must be true. I don't want that. You know? I want Sek Che Dar. Okay? Say Sek. Dar. Okay. Sek means, you know, burn it, cut it, test it, you know. Check what I say and check it. Take what I say and examine it, analyze it, rip it apart, tear it apart, criticize me, attack me, question me, you know. And if I can satisfy you, then accept it. And if I can't, then don't. You know, that is one of the most beautiful things about Buddhism to me. Is that, you know, the Lord Buddha is telling you from the beginning, you have to do this. You must do this, okay? What does Sek Che Dar mean? You know, it's kind of hard to burn words, okay? Sek here means check it against your own immediate personal experience, okay? Burn here or melt it means it's a code word for check it against your own direct experience, what you can see, what you can hear, what you can think about in a direct way. Okay, whatever I teach you, check it against your own direct experience around you, the things you can experience right around you. Check it against that. First test. Okay, then you have to what? Cut it. Okay, Che. You have to cut it. Cut here means check it against everything you understand logically. Okay. Is there a pen here? Hello? Is there a pen here? Boy, if you're in Geshe Thubten Rinzen's class and you don't move, you can ask Winston. He tortured some of those Americans. Okay. This is a pen, right? Okay. And then, you know, what do I have in my hand? It's a pen. And you're according to Buddhism, you're perceiving the pen just as well as with your eyes. Okay? Just as well. Okay. So does what the Buddha said fit everything you can think of? Okay? Much less what you know to be true directly. But how about everything you can figure out? You know, okay, I haven't seen the bottom of the Eiffel Tower or something, but I still understand some things about it. You know what I mean? Does what Lord Buddha said make sense? Okay? Or not, logically. Okay? This can be internal logic or external logic. Okay? Meaning, does he contradict himself or not? And does what he says match what I know to be true, even though maybe I can't see it with my eyeballs? Okay, that's the second test. Okay. Third test was what? Dar. Okay, dar here means, does what he said contradict something you know to be true because you heard it from someone you believe implicitly? Okay. Meaning, let's say that over many years you've gone to hear His Holiness speak, or Lama Serpa, or great lamas, Ken Rinpoche, and after many, many years of being with this person, being close to this person, you know, being intimate with this person, you understand that they must be telling the truth all the time. Okay, basically, you know, except when they're being figurative, right? They're not the kind of person who's going to purposely mislead you to hurt you, or they're not going to say something when they don't know it, you know. And over years, you build up this relationship with somebody, with a great lama, or somebody like that. And then, does what Lord Buddha said match those things which you yourself can't think of, or you yourself cannot understand, but you know great people who've said that? You see what I mean? Does it contradict what we know was spoken by holy beings that we trust? Okay. About things that we cannot see right now. We cannot understand right now. Okay? Those are the three tests. So the three tests of anything the Buddha said. First one, does it contradict your own direct experience? Second one, does it contradict what you can figure out to be true even though you can't see it directly? And then thirdly, does it contradict the words of somebody that you take to be a being who cannot lie and would not mislead you? Okay? About deep, deep things that you haven't experienced them yet, okay? Like that. These are the three tests. And Lord Buddha says, do not accept ever what I say just because I'm a good guy or Lord Buddha said so. He says, I don't want to hear that, you know? By the way, here, Jetsun Kapa ends up saying, look, basically there's one test for something being literal or figurative. How do you know what the Buddha really meant? Can you say, oh, because Lord Buddha said so? You can't. He said don't. Right? He said don't do that. Okay? You have to figure it out. You have to see what's logical. You have to figure it out. Especially about emptiness, okay? At the beginning, you can't see emptiness directly. You have to see it with your mind. You have to see it with your reasoning. You have to figure out what emptiness means. Okay? And Lord Buddha is saying, at the beginning, you're going to have to do that. If you want to know, if I was telling the truth on the first turning of the wheel, or was it the second turning of the wheel, or was it the third turning of the wheel, or none of the above, sorry, you have to figure it out. That's his answer, okay? And that's what each person here has to decide. Okay? Lord Buddha taught emptiness many different ways. And Lord Buddha said many things that don't seem to match each other. I mean, in those three occasions, first one he said, what? Everything's real, just the way it looks to you. Okay, your body is really there. You know, look, it bangs, it makes noise. You know, must be real. You know, I don't know who'd ever say anything else. Okay, and then second turning the wheel, he's like, hey, look, nothing real here at all, is there? You know, get it? You know, okay. And then in the third turning of the wheel, by the way, who triggers the third turning of the wheel? It's his bodhisattva. How does he trigger it? hey man, what do you mean you missed two turns in the wheel? You know? And then that becomes the third turning of the wheel. Got it? It's really cool. The third turning of the wheel was where the Buddha clarified what he meant in the first two. Okay, so the first turning of the wheel we call like the wheel about the Four Noble Truths or something like that. And then the second, turning of the wheel, by the way, means a whole decades of teaching on a certain subject by Lord Buddha with a certain flavor, you know, with a certain emptiness flavor. And then they didn't necessarily take place like very neat historical events, like he might have slid into the third one or the second one during the first one. You see, you can't just chop it off in 2000, you know, 538 BC, and that's the last time he said everything was self-existent, and then, you know, it's not like that. But in general, all those teachings where he said, yes, everything is real, are called the first turning of the wheel. And then when he got and said, no, no, nothing's real, those are called the second turning of the wheel. And then finally, this bodhisattva innocently asked him, you know, well, which one is right? And what did you mean when you said that? You know, and then that becomes the third turning of the wheel. His explanation, his words become the third turning of the wheel. Okay? And he says, don't believe what I say just because I said it. The only way you can figure out what emptiness really means is not even to just pick up a Lamrim or a Nagarjuna text or a Dalai Lama text. Can't do it. Lord Buddha said no. Okay? Lord Buddha himself said no. He said, ultimately, you got to believe the guy that you can figure out is correct. Okay? That's very interesting, you know. That's very interesting for our lives, you see. People can give you, I mean, it's very common in Tibetan circles, for example, to say, oh, those guys teach emptiness, they don't know what they're talking about. You know what I mean? I think I even said it tonight, probably somewhere. You know, oh, they don't know number two or something like that. Does that mean they're invalid? Does it mean they're wrong? John asked at the beginning tonight, you know, he said, which one is right? Which one is right? The one that's right for that student on that day is the one that's right, okay? You have to get used to that. You have to get used to that. Lord Buddha will emanate on this planet and teach emptiness in 100 different ways, and 99 will be wrong. Okay? And you have to thank those 99. You see what I mean? You have to go to them and say, you know, thank you for bringing me one step further in my understanding. You know, some guy gets up and says, emptiness is this yellow halo around your head, you know? And, you know, three people will believe him, and then they'll stick around for another class. And, no, and then the next time he'll say something a little more correct, and then he'll keep bringing them on further and further. And that's a method of a Buddha. What it means is one of the most important bodhisattva vow. What is the first bodhisattva vow? The easy answer is praising yourself and criticizing others. But what does it really refer to? Dr. Shimon, you know, what does it really refer to? Is it just praising anybody? I mean, praising ourselves any time of the day? We'd break it every day. We'd break it every 5 minutes. Huh? It's specifically criticizing another bodhisattva, another Mahayana teacher or Dharma group. You know, that's how you can smash your first bodhisattva vow. You know, to criticize out of certain bad motivations another Dharma group or another Dharma teacher. Then you've just smashed your first bodhisattva vow, you know. And the point is, the whole point of this class, really, in the end, is you don't know that they're not just Lord Buddha in school number 5 or school number 6. How do you know? Buddha did it all the time. Buddha spent his whole career in India pretending that the mind-only school system was true. And he knew it wasn't true. But he taught it for years, you know. And then he taught the Abhidharma system, and that was wrong too, but it helped people. You see what I mean? So, I mean, for us, Chang'e is very interesting. You don't know who those people are, you know. You don't know who they are. You know, you have to be really careful. This, I think the ultimate study of Chang'e is not just what emptiness is or isn't. It's that if Lord Buddha can pretend to hold four different schools during his lifetime, then what's to say he's not doing it nowadays? You know, and who are you to criticize this other group? You know, and by the way, you break your first bodhisattva vow. You get it. Does that mean you should stay quiet and not debate them when the good time comes, when the proper time comes? Not at all. You should. Okay? And you can take one side and they can pretend to take the other side, and you can beat them. They'll let you beat them. And then everybody will learn something. This is very common in the monastery. The wise older geshes come into the debate ground and pretend to forget something. And they make some statement that's wrong, you know. And they got this, they're like gunslingers, these 30-year-old geshes, you know. And they're like, oh, that's wrong, you know. They say, oh, really? And they say, yeah. And they say, oh, how do you prove that, you know. And then the guy will run around in circles for like an hour, you know, and not get it right. And then finally he'll beat the older geshe, and the older geshe says, oh, you're right, you know, you got me there. I've seen the abbot of Tashi Tenpo take his hat off to one of my classmates and set it on his lap and say, oh, you're too much, man. You know, and it's just tongue, you see? He knows that's not a good position, but he just taught 100 people something new. You know, so what it means is the ultimate tongue is you have to be very careful about the people. You don't know that the person next to you is not a Buddha, and you don't know that the people teaching some weird kind of emptiness are not trying to help people, you know. If it seems harmful to people, I mean, if they're teaching emptiness means you can do whatever the hell you want with your behavior, then you should go out and prove them wrong, okay? That's your duty in a happy way. But don't judge them. Be careful not to judge them. You don't know who they are, and you don't know why they're teaching it that way, okay? Something like that. You have to teach it the right way. Which one is the right way? I don't know. Okay, last thing. That last thing. Oh, I thought you might want to know what book you're studying. You know, the nice thing about this place is we can stay around 10:30. Say, Chang'e. Lekshe. Ningbo. Chang'e. Lekshe. Ningbo. Chang'e means Chang'e. I like to translate it as the art of interpretation, meaning how do you interpret the Buddha? Okay. If you want to, you can translate it as the figurative and the literal. Okay. Chang'e. For those of you who are studying Tibetan, sometimes two Tibetan words are counterposed to create a new quality, like tsadang. Hot, cold means temperature. Qiang, heavy, light, means weight. And it's almost a similar idea here, Chang'e being the study of interpretation. Okay. How do you interpret the words of a holy being? What happens if you don't get it right, by the way? Then you get these fanatical fights within a certain sect. You see what I mean? If you don't have proper ground rules for deciding what the founder of the religion meant, and when he meant what he said and when he didn't mean what he said, that's where you get real problems in a religion. You know, that's where you get severe problems in a religion. You know, somebody says, he said that. You know, Buddha said that. You have to, Buddha said monks and nuns can't own a piece of cloth more than 9 days. Period. You know, you say, no, that was when he taught Vinaya, but when he taught the Bodhisattva vows, he said, if somebody gives you a warehouse of cloth, you have to keep it for 9 years if it takes that long to find some poor people who can use it. And then you say, no, he said that, you know, and then you have to be able to know when to interpret. You know, it's a very important in every religion, and when not to interpret. A lot of people interpret the Buddha when he doesn't need interpreting nowadays, okay? Okay. Well, ever since. Lekshe. Say Lekshe. Lekshe means well-spoken. You can say eloquence. Some people have translated it as eloquence. I don't like eloquence so much, although I use it, because eloquence means spoken sweetly or poetically or something like that. That's not the point. It means spoken rightly. You see what I mean? Lekshe meaning yeah, what you say is true, spoken true. Okay? Ningbo means heart or essence. Okay? So if somebody says, what are you studying nowadays at that underground cafeteria, you know, and you say, what do you guys do when you go down there, you know? You say, oh, we do Chang'e Lekshe Ningbo. Say Chang'e Lekshe Ningbo. Chang'e Lekshe Ningbo. The essence of eloquence on the art of interpretation. Okay? The essence of eloquence on the art of interpretation. That's what we're studying. I mean, anyone who knows anything about Tibetan monasteries will say, oh my God, you know, are you all right? this is where they separate the men from the boys. This is where half the class drops out usually in the monastery. Who wrote it? Say J. Tsongkhapa. And then his dates are there, 1357 to 1419. Those of you who don't know, which shouldn't be many people, J means Lord, like Dorje, which means Lord of Stones. And then Tsongkhapa is the greatest Tibetan monk and thinker who ever lived, and the teacher of the first Dalai Lama. Okay. This book is called The Essence of His Lekshe. Okay? When we say essence of well-spoken stuff or something like that, we're talking about his writings. How many pages did he write? 10,000 pages. Okay, in the monastery, you can we often debate a single page for a month. It takes a month sometimes to understand a single page, debating it almost all day. You know, this guy wrote 10,000 pages like that in his life. Okay, people say he was taking dictation for Manjushri. Other people say he was Manjushri. Okay, I don't know. I can't decide. I don't know, but if you read his stuff, it's unbelievable, okay? And this is supposed to be the Ningbo of all that stuff. This little book is supposed to be the essence of everything he ever taught, okay? Like the heart, okay? I wanted to... First, the structure of his book is that he goes to the mind-only school's idea of when the Buddha was meant what he said and when he didn't mean what he said. And then he goes through the middle way school's idea of when the Buddha meant what he said and when he didn't mean what he said. Okay, so his whole book is divided into two big pieces. Okay, so if you belong to the mind-only school and you want to say, oh, this is what Buddha meant and that's not what he meant, you go to which book? You go to that chapter spoken by the Bodhisattva, requested by that Bodhisattva. Okay. By the way, the whole book has a name and you should know it. Okay. Yandat Pak, the chapter requested by Yandat Pak, by the Bodhisattva. Yeah. Remember that the whole fight's going to start out by this Bodhisattva saying, "Are you know, we know you're not crazy, so why did you say two different things?" Okay, that comes from a certain book. That's called the beginning of the chapter requested by such and such a Bodhisattva. Okay. That's where we take the question from. But that's only a little piece of a much bigger book. And this is the whole book here. Say, Dode,
Dode.
Gongdel.
Gongdel.
Dode,
Dode.
Gongdel.
Okay.
Very, very famous. All of the mind-only school's teachings come from the Dode Gongdel. So, you know, if you want to say, I understand the mind-only school, they're going to say, oh, then you're very familiar with Dode Gongdel, right? And you say, well, actually, I never heard of it. Okay? I mean, you can get lots of people in America, maybe they're speaking figuratively, but they have the weirdest ideas about the mind-only school. The name mind-only school does not mean what it says. It's figurative. They don't believe that everything is one big green, gray matter or something. Okay? They don't think that. That's figurative also, but we have to talk about that. They don't think everything is the mind. Okay. But their famous book is Dode Gongdel. Dode means sutras, meaning all the sutras that Lord Buddha taught, all those books that, all those teachings that Lord Buddha taught. Specifically in the first and second turnings of the wheel where he seems to have become schizophrenic. right? In the first teaching, he's like, everything exists real. And in the second turning, he's like, nothing exists real. Okay. So Dode means those sutras. Gong means, what did he really have in mind? You know, what was his true intent? Okay. Gong means that. Del means a commentary. Okay. Del means a commentary. So you can translate that as the commentary on the true intent of the sutras. It's an explanation of what the sutras really mean. Okay? Up to then you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sutras taught. Remember, sutra is like a brief sermon or a brief talk. I mean, tonight's lecture, if it were given by a Buddha, would be a sutra. Okay? And you have hundreds of them going on before that. And now you have a book called The Commentary, wherein we reveal the true intent of all those sutras. Yeah, did you have a question?
What's the difference between what you're talking about now and the essence of eloquence on the art of interpretation?
Okay. Essence of eloquence on the art of interpretation is a study done by Jetsun Kapa 2,000 years later, trying to figure out this book. Okay? Okay? And we study Chang'e from that book by Jetsun Kapa. He was the one who really, really opened it up. Jetsun Kapa was disturbed by the question of how do you know when the Buddha was speaking the truth or not? Now, what are the rules? We better set some rules, you know? Or people going to wander forever in suffering and die because they can't understand emptiness. Because how do you know which... He taught it 100 different ways. How do you know which one is the right one? You know, if you really study the sutras, it's very confusing. You know? If you go to 10 Dharma lectures in New York City, it's very confusing. Same thing. Yeah. It's a good question. I've been waiting for someone to ask this question. She said, oh, is that the Buddha's commentary? I mean, when I used to try to find this book, I used to look in all the Tengir, which is the commentaries to the Buddha, you know, and I couldn't find it in there. This is before computers, right? And I'd been looking for weeks, you know, and then finally one day I came across it in the sutras. It's the sutra in which the Buddha gives a commentary on his own sutras explaining what he really meant. Okay, you can call it the sutra where the Buddha explains the sutras. And paradoxically, it's called a commentary. You know, it's not a shastra. It's not a classical commentary. It is a sutra. It's the sutra where the Buddha said, "This is what I really meant when I taught those other sutras." How's that? Okay. Yeah.
In past courses, you've used the terms root text and monastic text.
Yeah.
How does that relate to these two titles?
He said root text and monastic text. Like if I had to do homework on this and it said, what's the root text for our study of Chang'e? I would put, if I wanted to cover my bases, right? Would I put the mind-only school's root text or would I put the middle-way school's root text? Because they're different root texts. There's different rules in the two schools. Mind-only school says, this is what he really meant when he said that. And then the middle way school says, nuh-uh, this is what he really meant when he said that. Oh, but I can prove it, I got this sutra. He says, well, I can prove it, I got this sutra. You know. So what's a safe course to take? Which one? Both? I don't know. That's wimpy. Vichari wouldn't do that. No, they're both base, they are the base books. Yeah, use Lama Tsongkhapa, okay? Especially if it says, what are his dates, you know? I mean, nobody's going to ask you Buddha's dates, probably, right? Unless it's a trick question, okay? Which happens, figurative. Okay, so this is the root text for whom? Mind only. Yeah, mind only. And it includes that chapter where the Bodhisattva asks the question. Because that Bodhisattva is, he's trying to incite Lord Buddha to give a mind-only answer. And Lord Buddha's going to fall for it. Poor guy. Okay? He's going to give the whole mind-only answer. This Bodhisattva has tricked him into this conundrum. Hey, first you said that, then you said that. What did you mean? And then he's going to give him an answer from the mind-only school. And that's the whole place where we're going to be. We're not going to go to the other text. But you better know his name, okay? And then we're done. We really are done. It's not figurative, it's literal. If you get stuck on the quiz, just do this much, okay? Well, sometimes they go lodu mi sepa. Say pakpa. Lodu. Mi sepe. Shube. Ndo. Pakpa. Lodu. Mi sepe. Shube. Ndo. Pakpa means someone who has seen emptiness directly. Okay. In Sanskrit, it's Arya. Lodu means wisdom. Misepa means never ending. Shubha means requested by this guy, this bodhisattva. Right. Do means sutra. So we can translate this line as the sutra which was requested by the Arya named Never Ending Wisdom. Okay, this is somebody's name. Sometimes they call it the Sutra of Never Ending Wisdom or something like that. Okay, but I want you to know that that's a person. Okay. This is the sutra that who uses to explain what the Buddha really meant? Yeah, middle way. Okay, we won't get to that. All right, because you've already had Majjhimika. We'll touch on it, but you've already had it pure 100%. You know it, okay? And in the monastery, we traditionally don't go to that second part. We cover the first part. Okay, yeah. He asked, is this similar to what Master Vasubandhu had in the Chittamatra school? There are what we call the two great innovators, or the two great original thinkers in this planet. One is Nagarjuna, and one is Asanga. Master Nagarjuna and Master Asanga. And Master Nagarjuna is the one who elucidated or re-elucidated the middle way school in this planet. And then Master Asanga is the one who elucidated or re-elucidated the mind-only school in this planet. Okay. Now, Master Asanga's half-brother was Vasubandhu, and they collaborated a lot. I mean, Master Vasubandhu did write two different sets of books. In one set of books, he was Abhidharma. He was writing from the Abhidharma viewpoint. By the way, in those books, he says, I'm just reporting what those stupid guys say. Okay. He doesn't call them stupid. And then... But he does have beautiful, beautiful books about the mind-only school, okay? Chittamatra or Yogacara. And we will be studying some of his books as well about the mind-only system, okay? So we're going to get next class. By the way, I think there's no class Tuesday. Okay, so on Thursday's class, we'll get into... What is the next logical thing to happen in the class, in the sutra? What happened so far in the sutra? Geshe Thubten Rinchen would never let you go. Yeah, you're going to get Lord Buddha's answer. Okay. The Bodhisattva is like, are you crazy? You know, first you say one thing, then you say another, you know. And now we're going to get Lord Buddha's response. Okay. All right, we'll do a short prayer and then we'll...
Riraving shimyante kempati Sange shindu mitte huwagi Jogu namda shimla shupashu Idam nirana mandakam niyatai
This is the end of Class 1. You have been listening to What the Buddha Really Meant with Geshe Michael Roach, presented by the Asian Classics Institute. The Asian Classics Institute is dedicated to preserving the pure teachings and practice of Buddhism. For a listing of other topics available, write to the Asian Classics Institute, P.O. Box 20373, New York, New York, 10009, or call 212-475-7752.